Sometimes you just got to begin to chase a dream that is bigger than you. Sometimes when it seems like you're so far behind, you'll never catch up. You got to get up on your feet. You can't wait on other people to be what you've been called to be.
Hello and welcome to the Ugly Daughter podcast. It's a privilege and honor to have Jimmy Tai, my brother, from a different mother, as my special guest today. Jimmy Tai came to America as a refugee in his 20s, empty-handed with no education or English language skills. His first job was a school cleaner. Today, he's a vice president for a Fortune 500 company and a keynote speaker. He serves on the board of directors for the National Association for Asian American Professionals in Southern California. He's also a founder of the Leadership Academy and a founder of a nonprofit charity organization called Build a School Foundation. Jimmy is one of the bravest, determined, and daring person I have ever known. Hello, and Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Hello, Julia. Thank you for having me, and hello to all of your audience in Down Under. Thunder Down Under, right?
Yes, Thunder Down Under. And Jimmy, I consider 1975 and the fall of Saigon the most significant political event that drastically changed the course of our lives and of millions of other Vietnamese people. After 1975, many of us frantically tried to flee Vietnam at a great personal risk, hoping to find freedom and build a better life elsewhere. Now, my family managed to escape on our first attempt. Though it was not easy, we were chased, shot at, but we were lucky to make it out alive. I believe you were not as lucky. You tried almost 1,000 times before you could finally escape. Can you kindly share your daring and painful adventure with our listeners today and tell us how old were you at the time and how did you manage to get out alive and what happened during the numerous attempts to escape?
Yeah, Julia, thank you for that honor. This question, right? So, I certainly wasn't trying to leave right away like most of the Vietnamese expats, right at the fall of Saigon in 1975. I stuck it out. Right? I lived for almost 10 years before I finally made it out. But I was a teenager, so that could be a plus because when you're a teenager, you're really fearless and you didn't really know much. And for me, certainly did not really know, much, for being, when the fall of Saigon, I already 10 years old, right? So I have the opportunity to live for almost, 10 years, with the new rulers. The thing that really, really struck me and I still remember is when I got into high school, even though I performed really, really well in high school, first freshman year in high school, I got I received a comment from one of my classmates, and he came from the north. You know, we call the victors, right? The descendant of the victor, and we are the descendants or the children of the loser. And
yep.
Make a remark
that,
hey, that's right, the loser, the traitors, or whatever the name that I want to label us at that time.
Yep.
Say, hey, it doesn't matter how smart you are, no way in hell that you can get to university because your father was a traitor. Your mother, you know, exploited our countrymen because she ran a business, never mind, really small business. but with all of this label, and I realized that, unless I try to leave and get educated and really learn, I don't really have much chance to grow up and be whatever I really want to be.
Mm.
And I think that really is the impetus to push me hard to decide it. And at that time, I'm already 15, right? 15. So I start to realize what right, what wrong, what true, what not, quickly. Like most of people, you know, after 5-6 years under the rulers, you realize that, hey, this is pretty dark. This is pretty grim. And, we don't really have a lot of chances. Just like you, your family make that hard decision. And I consulted with my parents, and they decided to make a really tough decision that let's try to find a way for you to leave. And knowing that from what we heard over the BBC, VOA, Voice of America radio broadcast at night, right? That's illegal to listen to those at that time. But we just like keep the volume really down and listen to what's going on. And we heard so many horrible sea journeys that people die, people encounter pirates, but then there's a gleam of hope because there's people got rescued by boat, right? Yeah. So that's why we look at the bright side and we say, hey, there's a chance, there's a hope, then we certainly go for it. And that's what I did.
I remember before my family escaped, we did listen to the radio.
Right.
We're definitely aware of the vicious storm and the pirates.
Right.
But because we live in a small fishing village and we witnessed the killing of our own people, I wouldn't say the authority because at this point it was two villagers.
Right.
I had no idea where they got their weapons from.
Right.
But every day they just sat at the bay and waited for the boats that were fully loaded with passengers. And the moment they saw those kind of boats, they just opened fire with their machine guns and they killed every single one on board.
Right.
Were you aware of the killing at the time?
You know, for the first couple failed attempts, I wasn't, I guess I was lucky because we were, the organizations or the planning, the organized trips was failed either due to an old engine that couldn't withstand sea state or, you know, all of that thing. But I remember it's about around in the middle of my 15th attempt. 15. Yeah, I make it very clear. Not 5, not 10, but 15. Yeah, I used to be a pretty bad boy. That's why I keep telling people. Or maybe I'm just a very slow learner. I just don't,
slow learner. Let me put it that way.
I just don't give up. I don't give up. When I believe in something, I will make sure I see to it. But in the middle of all of those trips, one time, our hidden, disguise was revealed, and just like you described just a minute ago, Julia, they opened fires on us.
Yeah.
And we pretty much just, you know, jumped into the water and swam for the riverbank and just tried to hide behind the bushes and just totally chaos. And unfortunately, during that encounter, older brother was shot and he was killed, and that's really unfortunate for our family to lose him that way.
So how did you escape, and while your brother, you know, got shot and killed, how did you escape that at that time?
For that trip, I was propelled myself up to the riverbank, and I ran into a resident there. It's a hut, and the old and the mother came out with two younger daughters, and she pretty much just told me, took off your wet clothes and muddy and everything, chained into one of the girls' outfit, you know, and she just hit me under her bamboo bed, only one bed in the house. She hit me under that, and she told the other daughter that, hey, go get some rag and wipe up his footprint.
Mm.
Because it's about 10, 15 minutes later, the local police were searching, you know, door by door and looking for fugitives and stuff like that. And I remember all the noise, and I was there, tried to hit my body, I pretty much just glued my body to the bamboo, to the clay floor under the bamboo, you know, bed in her bedroom. But I fully aware of what's going on outside. But I heard a lot of dog barking. I heard a lot of, you know, footsteps that people searching for, and I heard a lot of gunshots, and I heard a lot of, you know, people begging, and it's just total chaos. And for somebody 15, 16, it's probably burned in your memory. That drama. I still have goosebumps every time I thought about it.
While you laying there, trying to hide away from the authority, and you heard all the screaming, also the fresh memory of your brother just being shot and killed. What kind of thoughts ran through your mind at that time, man?
I realize how dangerous all of these things that we try to do.
Yeah.
And I cannot really say that you know, the price of freedom is free, or we don't, you know, don't take it for granted, because it's at 15, 16, that did not really sink in, right?
Yeah.
You really just try to survive at that moment amidst all this chaos, and you just say, hey, why him and why not me, right? Because if the bullet just move maybe a foot to either way, maybe he's the one that having the interview with you, not me, right? So that's the part that it hit me hard about life, about choices, and also about chance, the opportunity or the chance that the outcome of, you know, 2-3 people try to do the same thing, but the outcome may be completely different. And it have a huge impact in my view of life at a very early age.
Yeah. And witnessed all this killing when I was really young. And so I didn't know my parents wanted to escape, because, you know, it's a hush-hush thing and it's secretive and we did not talk about it. But I only found out when we got on the boat at midnight, and Dad tried to hit at us under the engine room.
Right.
And when we came out to the sea, we were allowed to get on, you know, on the deck of the boat.
That's right.
When my dad said we were escaped in Vietnam, that's when I felt that my whole spirit left my body, and I was so tempted to jump off the boat and swim back to shore, because surely I didn't want to die.
I want to live. I want to live. I'm too young to die.
So I think you are incredibly courageous and fearless, because, I mean, at 15, I'm sure you are, you know, you're fully aware of what's going on.
Right.
But I also think you're almost foolish for taking so many chances and putting your life at risk for a chance, you know, to have a better life or to get an education elsewhere. So how many times were you caught on?
I was captured twice. And they sent me to prison. The first time that they caught me, I wasn't stay in the prison long, because just 2 weeks after I escaped the prison.
Wow. That's very generous of our authority.
No, I escaped the prison.
Oh, you escaped the prison.
I escaped. They did not let me go. I escaped, because I look at it and I say, well, this is not good.
How did you escape? I thought it was a really, like, a secure prison. How could you escape?
Oh, contrary to belief, because remember this one, I was captured in Trang Bang Thoi district, right? And they have a prison cell is something very, very rudimentary built, right? So it's pretty much like the places that you keep probably buffaloes or cows, more than for human, but it's a misship, you know, prison. But they do have guards with guns, with machine gun and everything. But I study their behavior, and I study their schedules. So I figure that even at night, you know how in the south,
it's
cold and it's no light, and it might rain, it get wet, and people just go sleep. Yeah. Nobody think that everybody there to escape.
And
I waited for a rainy night, and I just sneak out. Because I was skinny enough that when they have all of these wooden bars, I found a spot that with the perfect curve of the two bars next to each other, that my head can sneak through, right? So I can snuck my head through and I slide my body over. And I was pretty frail. I'm only about probably 80, 90 pounds at that point. So I certainly can get through that way. And I just went into the middle of the night. I just get through, and I just, you know, ran really fast into the nearby, you know, jungle bushes, and just, you know, follow the river and found my way back to the, you know, Kamau City.
Wow, you are truly mad. And
now I look back, I really feel like I'm completely fearless, because there's nothing stopped me. You know, when I set my mind to action, you know what? I really need to leave. I really need to go educate myself. I really need to go figure out a way for, you know, to do things better for other people. I'm really determined at that age. Yeah. And the second time that I got caught, they sent me to the same prison, and then people just beat the crap out of me. And they say, like, you need to tell us how did you do it last time. And this time they really, really put, you know, they just put all of these, handcuffs, and they, even the ankle, cup yeah. on me. So the last, the second time, I did try to escape again yeah. later on yeah. after the couple of weeks, because I'm only 15, 16. So after a while, they put me to do other labor camp work thing. And every time I go out there, I will start looking for the way that I can sneak out. So, yeah. I guess I really, they make you do labor work, like, you know, work in the fields, you know, grow crops. Clear out all these vegetation so they can grow crops. Yeah. Very, very, very intense labor work.
Yeah.
But not anything that, you know, harsh. Just because, it's not life-threatening. It's just a lot of labor work. You just have to work in the field. That's all.
And then you just took off?
No, I studied the path.
And again?
I have to study the path, and I wait until nighttime, nightfall. And you know, wait for the right timing and make sure that there's no dog, there's no guard still awake, because you know how much it rains down the Mekong Delta. So I just wait for a really dark and rainy day, and I just try to sneak off out again.
That's unbelievable. Well, I have to say that I truly admire you for your courage. So, where did you land first, and how many months did you have to stay in a detention center before you allowed to settle in the USA?
So I say after the 2 years of trying, I finally make it out, and I get it to Thailand. So Thailand was the first country that I be able to land it after Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I remember that I wasn't stay long in a refugee camp, right? They call it the refugee camps then. Because this is in the early 80s. So it wasn't that dire strait. And I think Americans still funded most of the refugee camps at that time. This is before they decided that, hey, we need to terminate this program.
Yeah.
So I remember that I wasn't staying long in camps at all. And maybe because I'm young and I'm probably in the prime age to do labor in other countries. I think that I got accepted to migrate to America pretty quickly after that.
Yeah. So did you choose to go to the USA, or was it determined by the UNHCR?
I think I always, because there's a lot of people keep telling us, you know, the goal is always go to the USA. So that's what, you know, when people, I go to the interview, I say, no, I just want to go, I just want to come to America. Just please, you know, give me that. I don't know. If they end up sending me to Mexico, probably I will hop on the plane and go to, I mean, because you and I probably didn't know the difference between Mexico and America, but just because everybody say, let's go to America, this American dream. And I think that's why I say, oh, I just want to come to America. And thank God they did. So let me go to America.
I'm sure if they decided at the time to put you in Mexico, I'm sure you're going to only stay there for a few weeks, and then you're going to climb over the fence.
or maybe I could be, you know, a Mexican dude by now. I have no idea
how life turned out,
right?
You would jump the fence.
Yeah, cross the border.
Cross the border, yes. So you came to America alone with pennies in your pocket and hardly spoke a word of English. Can you tell us the kind of struggles, challenges, sacrifices, and not to mention financial hardship you had to go through to get to where you are today?
Yeah, I think I remember vividly on the long flight from Thailand to America. I didn't know much English at all. And you know, every time people on the flight ask me if I want something, the only words I know back then is Coca-Cola. That's all I answer. And she asked me for something to drink, just Coca-Cola. Even when she, you know, I remember it's at dinner time, I still say Coca-Cola. So she gave me Coca-Cola to drink for that 18 hours flight. And I think I have enough sugar in my body for the rest of my life from that trip. But you know, that just emphasized the points of the language barrier that I had at that point, right? So you asked the correct, like, when I arrived, it hit me, hey, I'm almost 20 now, how am I going to survive in this country, how am I going to make a living, and what I'm going to do? So that's when it really hit me hard that, oh, I got to come to America now, then what? But luckily, when you got sponsor to come over here. They help you settle, and then they say, hey, at your age, the only thing you can do is right now just go learn English. And then try to, you know, get into, find a job or do something. And to me, that's fine because, you know, all my life, I'm ready to work. I'm determined. Yeah. So when I say, oh, okay, let's go learn ESL, you know, English as a second language at the local community. And I look around and I try with my broken English. I just tell people and I say, I really need to work because without work, I don't think my sponsor will keep me long.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, the cafeteria might need somebody to mop the floor.
Yeah.
And I say, oh, sign me up. I can do that. I don't have to talk to anybody, right? All I have to do is just mop the floor and clean the toilet. And that's how they gave me a job first. And that's how I started.
It must be tough for you, Anne, because you came from a decent background, right? Your parents, they're not poor. I'm guessing that they middle class people. And so life wasn't really hard for you in Vietnam comparing to the USA for your first few years.
I say after 9 years or living after the fall of Saigon, certainly thing is rough. But you're absolutely correct that, you know, even those we was from the upper middle class before the fall, or even after the fall, we still try to keep the image. For me, working and cleaning toilet or go wash car is something I never thought about. You know, I would do that in my life.
That's right. Very degrading.
By the Vietnamese standard.
That's right.
But when you get here, and for me, when I realize how lucky I am to be alive, when you and I are fully aware, a lot of people did not you know, have that chance. Either they die, or they wasn't lucky, or you know, they you know, they bury in the middle of the ocean, 1,000 you know, miles under. So I have a sense of appreciation pretty quick, pretty fast. So that's really shaped me, about, you know, about get my hands dirty, do the work. And I'm determined to be educated. So I figure, hey, I need to go to college. So I need to find a way to support myself and put myself through college somehow. And in a way, I kind of thankful for that opportunity, to tell you the truth, that I have a chance to work and put myself through community college.
Yeah. So how did you grow from being a janitor all the way up to become a vice president?
I think once you finish the first year or two at community college, and I transferred to UCSD, and that's another appreciation, because even after I've been in this country for only 2 years, still with limited ability to speak English at that time, UCSD, a really, really well-known university, in San Diego, accepted me to their engineering program. So I think with determination, with luck, and also with the given opportunity, you certainly can make the best out of it. And that's what I did. I seized the opportunity. I started pretty hard. I worked pretty hard when I'm at UCSD, and I graduated and got my engineering degree, got job offers, start working, and then start learning more. Got my master and then got my MBA.
Yeah.
And like I said, the rest of history, you know, I keep learning. I keep trying to improve my communication and my leadership skill. And when the opportunity knocked, people you know, all of my mentors realized my potential and gave me opportunities. So I'm always thankful for that.
So during your darkest hours, what kind of story you told yourself to give you strength and hope to keep going?
I think that's a very, very honest question, because like most of us that going through the changing process, many, many times we just want to give up, right? Because the obstacles seem to be insurmountable, impossible to overcome.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have money, and you don't know the language, you don't know the culture, everything is so foreign to you.
That's right.
And then you can be frustrated, because when you try to study and you have to use a dictionary to look up words, so you can do your homework or stuff, it can be daunting.
Yeah.
But I think I'm always remembered about my brother, first of all. So I realized that, hey, he never had this chance.
Yeah.
So I cannot take these chances or squander it, right? So I don't want to waste that golden opportunity that my brother would never ever have.
Yeah.
And secondly, during the 15 attempts to leave, I got the opportunity to encounter a lot of the Vietnamese children from the countryside that, you know, that left a very, very long-lasting image in me that someday I have to come back and help them.
Yeah.
So usually those are the images that help me overcome. And on top of that, you know, the wonderful support from family, from mom, you know, the people that, you know, reunited with us later. So it's always the family, the love of the loved ones is always give you, you know, courage to go through all the difficult times.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you actually turned, you know, your misfortune, and especially the death of your brother, into something positive that keeps you going. So if you could do it all over again, what would you do differently, Ian?
You know, I've been asked this question many, many times, pretty much every week.
Oh,
every time
I thought I was the first one to ask.
yeah, but you know what? My answer is probably going to be very original.
Yeah.
I do believe that even though, you know, I'm past my midlife crisis stage, I do believe that life is so much to live forward, right? So I look back, I never ever think about any moment that I would regret.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be brave enough and try to save my brother, but I don't know, at 15 when bullets is all surrounded you by bullets, I don't know if you really have a courage or a moment to think straight of how
and
to
Jimmy,
do or what to do.
Let me stop you right there.
Yeah.
It was the greatest decision that you ever made not to save your brother, because you could have been 6 foot under just like him. I was there. I witnessed the whole thing. Nobody would be able to survive.
It could be because I remember the mother that harbored me that night. She said the same thing. Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know how. She just said, hey, with that many bullets, she said, like, I'm amazed that you're still alive.
Yeah.
Because I figured that, you know, waiting to the next morning, I go out to the riverbank, probably I found a lot of corpse.
Yeah.
And she just amazed that I was alive.
Yeah.
But get back to your question. When I look back, all of this, I think it built characters.
Mm.
It built characters, it built appreciations, and it built determinations.
Yeah.
And I use all of this as the leverage to propel myself and to forward and do good things for people. So I'm really looking forward to what I can do for the next 2-3 decades rather than look back what I could have done in the last 3 decades.
That's a wonderful answer. Didn't expect that. You were mentioned earlier that during your escape, you ran into all these kids from the small villages.
Right.
And that's something that kind of like burned into your psyche. And
right.
You wanted to return one day to help them. What do you mean by that, Ann?
Yeah, I remember one time I was down in Hondapak, Gamau, right? So
yeah.
You're probably familiar with the Gamau province.
Yes.
While waiting for my boat, I was with this fishing, you know, family. And at night, while we have nothing to do and no electricity, nothing, right? So just by the oil lamp, I kind of realized pretty quickly the 8-year-old boy in that house is completely illiterate.
Yeah.
And to me, that'd be surprising because 8 years old, then he should be in 3rd grade, right?
Yes.
Or something like that. So I just say, no, no, no. His name is Min, by the way. And I say, you know what? Go find me some newspaper and I'm going to start read to you and I'm going to start teach you how to read. Yeah. And I finally told him that, hey, if you can find me some material I can read and I can teach you how to read and write.
Yeah.
So he left, he walked away and he came back with the crumpled newspaper that his mom used at the, to wrap, you know, good that she sold the market and some leftover. So they really crumpled. We strained it out and then I start reading him out to read. And we did that for about 4 or 5 days while I'm there every night. He getting very eager. Every night he kind of waiting for me with all this crumpled newspaper from his mom. And that make me feel so good that I taught him how to read and he traced every single letter. And then we read, it doesn't matter what topic.
It's amazing because when I'm back in Vietnam, because we lived so far away and been isolated from the civil world, you know, we literally live in the jungle. And there was no school on, even if you want to learn, nobody gonna teach you or no school to go to. So, you know, what you're doing now is amazing. So Lately, you set up a non-charity profit organization called BUA School Foundation.
Correct.
And right. I believe it in less than a year, you built 6 schools to provide the opportunity for the underprivileged to get an education. You right. also built a bridge to replace a makeshift flying fox that's saving countless students from drowning on their way to schools.
Right.
There are 3 more schools under construction. How is it possible to build so many schools in such a short time?
Yeah, I think there's two folds to your question, Julia. First of all, like me mentioned, just the image of Nineveh came to my mind. And yeah. I make a promise to myself that if I ever make it out and got a chance to be educated, yeah. I will return to build school. For, because, you know, even though a couple of decades later, there's still a lot of Mings back in Vietnam yeah. that did not have a chance to learn in the rural area right now, right? In the mountain or down the Mekong River. I knew that. That's a reality. So that's why, first of all, I really determined to go and help them because that's a promise I make to this little boy long, long times ago. I want to live up to my promise. And second, when I share that with people, they really, really realize that this is the right thing to do, right? So when you have a strong message that you want to share with people and you believe in your conviction
yeah.
and you share with people, I got a lot of support. I could not have done any of this by myself, Julia. I got the wonderful team. I got the wonderful, you know, people that support me. A lot of my students in Vietnam, a lot of contributors, a lot of donors, they are wonderful people. They believe in the mission that, you know, we build a school and then we leave a legacy. And that's why we be able to do things so quick, so fast.
So how do you find the sites and can you walk us through the approval process?
Yeah, and I think the first thing is I have to rely on all of my graduates, right? Because I return to Vietnam a couple of times a year to teach, you know, college graduate student professional
yeah.
That working for multi, you know, nation companies. And even though I teach them on public speaking, on project management, on leadership, on decision making, but when I share all of these personal stories about my dream to build schools, a lot of them touch and a lot of them say, you know what, teacher, I will help you. I came from that town. I know there's a lot of people struggling, even though I make it through. I come to the big city to live.
Yeah.
There's a lot of my children in the village still going through this. So they're the one that helped me find the location.
Yeah.
And then we set up a process to work with the local you know, community leader or, you know, the district education office. And we say, hey, we're ready to help you to build school. You just need to tell us where's the site, give us the budget, give us what we do. But the unique about our program, because I don't want this to become a handout. That means I don't want to go build 100%.
Yep. Right?
I want this to be a hands up. That means I want people to feel good about the collaboration with our foundation.
Yep.
Therefore, I set the guideline that I only help them, you know, up to 50-60%.
Yeah.
The local got to come up with the rest because I want them to have skin in the game. That's way when I walk away or after I'm done, things will not fall apart. When people, you know, have skin in the game, they will keep it up.
Yeah, that's amazing because I've been involved with a lot of charities.
Right.
They had great intentions to go to the third world and build school, provide education for the underprivileged. But the execution was just horrible because, you know, a lot of time the money actually went to the wrong hand and
right.
it was misused and abused. And mm-hmm. then a few short years later, the school just fall apart because
right.
nobody takes pride in it and they don't
right.
really care about the school. So what you're doing is extremely important, you know, to get
right.
the locals and everybody involved. In,
right.
in a project and make sure that they maintain it for many, many years to come.
That's right. Yeah, I learned a lot about other people's mistakes because before I decided to do this, right, I'm even today after almost 10 school, a lot of people still ridicule what I'm doing
yeah.
because they figure, hey, this is just like you try to print salt and put it back in the sea, right? That's the Vietnamese expression. And they say, how many can you help? But to me, it doesn't really matter because unless we get up our butt and do something,
yeah.
change will never happen. And if I just change one life,
yeah.
I just build one school, I'm satisfied, right? So if I build 10, It's great. And if I can build 100, it's wonderful.
One life at a time. And
that's right.
I'm very grateful for people like you and with that kind of mindset. Because without people like you, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. I would have no education. I would be dead somewhere.
Right.
You know, you never know who you save and that you never know what that person could potentially do for the society. Yeah. So what was it like to return back into your homeland decades later?
I think the ironic is that Julia, the first time I came back in 2007, I was invited back by the Vietnamese Academy of Science and Technology, right? Because they know that I'm supposed to be the expert in tsunami warning and earthquake forecast.
Yeah.
So Vietnamese government invited me back. So the first time that I was get the invitation, I asked my mom because, you know, the loss of my brothers and all of these things still in me, even though, you know, it's been 20 years later or so. And my mom said something that, you know, stays with me forever. She said that the people that shot your brother or the people that hurt our family might not be the same people that you try to save. Yeah. God forbid if there's a tsunami or something. By the way, we our company did provide all the tsunami warning for Australia government as well. So that's my first customer. I'm with the first project manager to run the project for the Bureau of, you know, Meteorology of Australia. That's why I'm very, very feel close to you when you contact me.
Yeah.
But get back to your question. When I come back the first time, at the scientists and share my stories with a lot of these people. Eventually, my story got catch on, and then people just say, "Hey, what you try to do is hard, but if you really believe in what you're doing, maybe one of these days somebody will find out, you know, what you want to do, and they might help you."
Yeah.
And yeah, it took me almost 5 years later before I ran into one of my students that shared the same thought process and the same dream at I am a building school for the poor.
Yeah. Wow. That's wow. Everything happened for a reason. And
that's right.
You know, I'm glad that, you know, I'll be able to be part of your vision and helping you along the way. So I know raising money is not easy and it takes thick skin and great self-confidence because like you constantly face rejections and skepticism.
Right.
I've done that all my life and now my skin's so thick, it's unbelievable.
I bet.
So how do you face these challenges and then what do you say to those that who don't really believe in your worthy cause?
I think you're absolutely correct that, you know, raising money is not hard because you call it fully aware that million of organizations out there try to do good things,
yeah.
Right? We certainly don't say any other good organization is better than others.
Yeah.
But I do believe when I set out the model for our foundation and build a school, leave the legacy.
Yeah.
And I make it very simple to people. There are three things here, right? Build a school. School is education. School is hope for the future generation. So who in us is not concerned about education and who in us is not want to give a better life for future education.
Yeah.
And second, when I say build, that's all about construction. That's about job for the local, right?
Yeah.
Because I want the parents, I want the local people feel proud of their accomplishment, how they contribute to the community.
Yeah.
And the last thing is that I explain to people that, you know, like you or your peer or a lot of other folks here, after I have the chance to attend, you know, Harvard University, so I can learn how to manage all this nonprofit organization.
Yeah.
You don't take money away from donors in America, in Australia, or in Europe to bring back to Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
You don't do that. You give these compassionate people an opportunity to contribute, right?
Yeah.
So actually what we do, we offer opportunities to folks that really believe in this, but have no way, you know, to meet what they passionate about, right? So that's why when I share with people like that, the people that really on board like you or like hundreds other, it's not a problem at all. I have so many students, so many donors say, "I help you build a school, Jimmy, not a problem."
Yeah.
And I start to now the people that say no, because for those people, it doesn't matter how thick of our skins are. They will say no because they will never donate.
Yeah.
And or their heart is not in the right place, right? Or they'd rather go feed the homeless or they do some other wonderful thing. And I respect that. So I'm fully aware of what people enjoy doing, even a charity, and I only recruit the people that share the same vision and the same mission.
Yeah.
Right. So it just makes life a lot easier that way.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
What have you enjoyed most about this project so far?
I think that's a tough question to answer, because I don't think there's only one thing that I can answer that question. Yeah. Julia, I enjoy every single moment, because every time that I got a chance to go back there, and I'm not there all the time for every single opening, yeah, project opening. Sometimes I have to have my student to be there for me, because, yeah, you know, we all have a family and a life that we try to balance and maintain. But I say there's nothing warm my heart more than see the smiles, all of these, you know, less fortunate children's faces, right?
Yeah.
So even though you just give them a few candies, or you give them a box of instant noodle or whatnot, when you see their face lit up, and when you see those smiles,
yeah,
those are unforgettable moments.
Yeah.
And they give me so much energy to go home and work until 1 o'clock in the morning, or, you know, talking to people that 17 hours, you know, time zone different away from us. I have so much energy. I have so much passion, because I just want million more faces,
yeah,
you know, smile and be happy.
So, Jimmy, what is your greatest hope?
I think if I can contribute whatever within my small, ability to eradicate poverty and, you know, income inequality through education, right? Through education. Because I do believe education, especially with younger minds, children, provide hope for the children. And then that will be the change for a country, for a community, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. And that really is my hope. My hope is just that every single child in Southeast Asia have a chance to be educated.
I believe in Jimmy that you not only raise the funds through the sponsors and to the supporters, but you personally have been contributing lots of your money that you, especially your income that you made from your own Leadership Academy Foundation,
right,
and also
right,
your book to
right,
put in this project. Am I correct?
That's correct. All the money all the proceeds that I can generate from all the teaching. Like last 2 weeks when I was there, I taught a couple of classes, and I generated about $6,000, and that helped me build one and a half school right there.
Wow. So,
yeah, so everything we earn in Vietnam stay in Vietnam. That's my philosophy. I don't need to bring it back to the States, right? We okay over here.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously you are financially independent, and you don't really need to, you do not get paid for doing this job. And also all the volunteers, they do not get paid, right?
That is absolutely correct. All of our volunteers, all of our contributions, all of these expenses, travel expenses, when we do this thing, strictly come out of our pocket.
Wow.
Because the money that we raise, that's 100%. And I say 100% goes straight to build a school, because
yeah,
like you said, most of us are lucky enough, and you know, God bless us enough with,
yeah,
to be financially independent, or intelligently enough to have a job, to have a secure, you know, life. So we just devote it to do good work for people, and we want to make sure 100% of our donation go to build school.
Wow. I'd like to add something else. I think it's more than 100%, because you raise the money, and then you get the community and the locals to raise the other half. So
right,
if you're looking at it that way, that would be like we are doubling the money that we raise, you know, to build a school.
That
right, is more than 100%, right?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the return on investment and the local contribution, yeah, you're absolutely correct, because, I mean, we can motivate people, we inspire people, and at the same time, we teach them how to take care of themselves, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not going to be here and do this thing for them forever.
Yeah.
And that's part of my teaching philosophy, is that, hey, I'm going to give you the fish and rod there, and then
yeah,
just give you the fish.
Yeah. I have the same philosophy, and that's why I contacted Anne, because I've been doing charity for more than 20 something years. And a
right,
lot of time, I think that the best the best charity organizations that I've found, you know, for the past years, that they at least they spend at least 20% to the admin and to, you know, other stuff. And right. I was not happy with that, even 80%, while others, you know, they spend up to 80% on admin right. and everything else. So the moment I read your story through Toastmasters magazine, right. which is congratulations, you were the only Vietnamese in 85 years being featured on the magazine.
Yay, we made it.
Yeah, I'm very proud of you.
I'm so thankful for Toastmasters for you know, supporting me on this compassionate journey. Yeah, I cannot say enough about that wonderful organization.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful too, because without Toastmaster, I wouldn't be able to get in touch with you or find you from the first place. So
that's right. That's right.
So, but anyway, recently you published your book called The American Dream. I read your book and right. I was crying for, I think, about 2 hours. I got emotional because of the story that you told about your brother, and it brought back all these horrible memories. So that was one part of the book. What I love about your book is that you have so many wonderful tips that you share with the readers.
Right.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what's in there, and also to share with the listeners, what kind of lessons can they draw from reading your book?
I wrote by secrets to the American Dream book because long overdue. So many people keep asking me, hey, your story was fascinating, Jimmy. Why don't you write in a book? And I say, oh my God, I'm broken English. I'm ESL. I'm engineer. Are you kidding me? You know, writing a book.
Yeah.
But then finally, I just think about if I have something that I leave behind for my two daughters to read, to understand where they came in from, that would be something worth doing. And that's why, you know, I finally penned the book. But when I mentioned about Five Secrets and the word American Dream, just shortly to me, five letter dream, D-R-E-A-M, stands for what I believe is you must be very determination. So that's the first letter, determination. The R stands for respect the privilege. Like, I really, really respect the privilege of being an American, or be the citizen of any country for that matter, right? Yeah. You have to respect the privilege of that. And the education is really important. If I don't learn, then I'm not going to be better myself. And if I'm not better myself, I won't be able to help anybody else.
Yeah.
Aim high. That's the letter A. That's aim high. Why stop at building one school? Well, let's go for 100. why stop at being in America and settle with a janitor job? Let's go get degrees and go all the way to the top, right? But the last letter, M of dream, to me, that's the letter that makes a difference. To me, that's the most critical, because if we fulfill our dream for ourselves, then we not be any better than anybody else, because all we care about is us. But the minute we think about other people less fortunate than us, like all the less fortunate children, like many, many Mings in Vietnam, and devote our energy and effort to help them, that truly is the dream.
Yeah.
Right? Because the dream is really help other people that are less fortunate than us.
Yeah.
So the only thing that I advise the reader is that when you accomplish something to satisfy your family, your individually, then the next step is then what, right? What can we do for the people that not as fortunate as we are?
I think that's a wonderful advice. And so I can't wait for the September walk. So far, I think I have about 20 supporters signing up, which is, you know, it's really blown my mind away. I started to, you know, like have a active campaign yet. I just listed on Facebook, and
right.
I'm just amazed so many people sign up and willing to come for a walk with me. Can you tell us a bit about the walk in September?
Yeah, September 18th. So that's a Sunday. And I know that it's more or less like my Saturday, because you 17 hours ahead of me, sister.
Yeah.
So you will finish the walk, and I will, you know, be so excited to hear all the wonderful things about you. But basically, what we try to do in six cities here is that we do the 5K walk, and everybody can join us. And all we ask for is that people, you know, show up, bring five friends, and each of them only need to donate $5. I really believe that, you know, we don't need much. We just want to raise awareness of our Build School Foundation. And anybody want to come and say, oh, $5? That's easy. I can donate that. Can I donate 50? Sure. Can I donate 500? More power to you. And I have a lady say, oh, I want to build one school by myself. Jimmy, how about 5,000? Yeah. And I say, thumbs up to you, sister.
Give me the check right now.
Yeah, so I say the more the merrier. But yeah. The key is really is that, you know, I believe in what we do.
Yeah.
And you are another testament to this, Julia. You did not do any advertising. You have more than 20 of your friends want to jump in. And that really is what we try to do, right? We try to get out there with friends, with family, to have a very healthy, pleasant walk, find a park, do something like that. But at the same time, any money that we can generate from this, we know that it would be so great because we change so many lives for kids in Southeast Asia.
Yeah. And you also offer free lunch, I believe. Free pho or something I saw on your ad.
at least for San Diego, we will try to take everybody to go eat pho because that's my favorite food.
Okay. I think it's too expensive for me to fly over there. Better stick in Australia.
Oh, I will make sure I order pho and send it over to you for all the wonderful
things
that you've done for
us. Thank you. I definitely will keep an eye on my mailbox.
That's right.
Instant we want to make sure that we have instant pho.
No, we make sure that we've frozen it and then we send it over.
I don't think it will last for 20-something hours on the flight, right?
If people can pack and bring lobster back to Vietnam, I'm pretty sure next time when I fly to Australia to see you, I can pack pho for you.
Too much hassle and we have good pho here. I'll take you to the good restaurant here.
Oh, sounds good. That's certainly a date, you know, for sure.
Before we go, and what other advice do you have for our listeners and potential supporters today?
Yeah, first of all, I really want to say thank you so much for everything that you have done for the organization, for the foundation, Julia. You've been a strong advocate. And that's the part that make me really, really touch, right? I met the people that already read my article in Toastmaster magazines or seen the interview on the Sandra Tribune or whatnot. And then the next thing I know, we become like best friends.
Yeah. I see you as my brother, that's for sure. I have two brothers, but we don't really have a great relationship because they have their own personal issue.
Right, we all have the power to change. Yeah. Right? We all have that power to change, whether big or small. And once we exercise that power together, we can make a huge difference. And yeah. That's all I'm asking everybody to do.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to be part of your amazing organization called Build a School Foundation. And I truly, truly can't wait to see your vision become a reality.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, many thanks for sharing your story and for your time today. And I really appreciate it. And it's been a great pleasure talking to you today. So I know you're a busy man and you gave me more than an hour of your time. That's amazing.
The pleasure is all mine. Yeah, I would love to see my Australian sister one of these days. And I would like to say thank you to all of your listeners.
Yeah, thank you. And I wish you have a great afternoon.
All right. Likewise. And we talk later, okay?
Yeah, take care and bye for now.
All right. Bye.
Bye. That's all for today. Thank you for listening. I hope to see you all again next week. Bye for now.